What is it like to be one of the citizen soldiers summoned to duty in Iraq and Afghanistan? We're speaking with Michael Mushno and Susan M. Ross, authors of Deployed, How Reservists Bear the Burden of Iraq. Using the soldiers' own voices, Deployed draws upon the life stories of members of an Army Reserve MP company who were called to extraordinary service after September 11. The book explores how and why they joined the Army Reserve, how they dealt with the seismic changes in their lives during and after deployment, the evolution of their relationships inside and outside their military unit, and their perspectives on the U.S. Army. Perhaps most important, Deployed challenges the prevailing stereotype of returning soldiers as war-damaged citizens.
Michael and Susan, thank you for talking to me.
Happy to be here.
Well, thank you for having us.
Great. So the first question I wanted to ask you is the inspiration or motivating reason for writing your book. What was missing, if anything, from the public discussion that made this book, in your view, necessary?
Well, Joe, this project came looking for us more than our setting out to write a book about deployment of reservists. Susan and I came to know each other in 2002 and 2003 at Lycoming College, a small liberal arts institution in central Pennsylvania, where Susan has been a professor for several years, and I returned as a visiting professor to my undergraduate alma mater. By the time the two of us had met and struck up a friendship, Susan already had several reservists receiving orders and deploying.
Okay.
Susan can best describe these circumstances.
Okay, Susan.
Well, thanks, both of you. Within the small college setting, you know, deployed students and alumni started corresponding with me, and their letters from Afghanistan and then later Iraq tended to reveal stories of fear, anxiety, and frustrations, as well as personal triumphs. And Michael and I started to have long conversations about the wars and the letters that, from these students. We questioned if we were looking at this generation's Vietnam.
Yes.
Had these students gotten more than they bargained for when they signed up as young men and women to serve? Would they still have friends or even understanding peers once they returned to the classroom
right.
in the war zone? And would they themselves be able to pick up in their studies where they'd left off? So we weren't certain how they would handle the transformation from relatively cloistered undergraduates to wartime soldiers and back again. So we began talking about how we might use our positions and knowledge to give voice to the experience of citizen soldiers who've been called to fight after 9/11.
Okay.
So, you know, just to pick up on that, we started talking about doing a project, and so we read accounts about soldiering, popular accounts, academic, contemporary ones, historical ones. To our surprise, we found little to share with the student soldiers that seemed helpful to them or us. Turning to our own expertise in past field projects, we concluded that the best contribution we could probably make would be to use our positions to enable reservists, like those called from the classrooms at Lycoming, to tell their stories about becoming citizen soldiers, being deployed, and then also what it was like after they came home.
Okay. So your decision to include significant portions of the soldiers' raw responses to your interview questions makes for a very personal account of their lives. Was there ever a discussion of approaching the book in a different way than this, or how did you go about putting the book together from the beginning?
Actually, we went after their voices from the get-go, Joe. Our job was, in our imagination and where we started, our job was to create questions for conducting conversational interviews with the soldiers that would allow us to hear their life stories, both before and after 9/11, as kids, grown-ups, civilians, and soldiers. And while we have a story to tell about these conversations, we make sure that the story is told as much through their voices as our own.
Okay. So why did you choose this particular unit rather than, say, one from later in the Iraq and Afghanistan wars?
Well, the men and women of the 893rd were among the first wave of reserve soldiers to experience multiple deployments following 9/11. Their first year was a stateside deployment, and then after a very short break, they were deployed, and this time to Iraq for nearly a year. They entered Iraq shortly following the President Bush's declaration aboard the USS Abraham that mission in Iraq had been accomplished. And they finally came home with the complete understanding that they were fighting what was clearly shaping up to be a long war that would involve American troops as first combat and then peacekeeping forces for years to come.
Okay.
And then they made frequent comparisons to the American involvement in both Vietnam and more recently Bosnia. I think these citizen soldiers experienced the Iraq War at the same time that the United States military was essentially playing catch-up with the Bush administration's declared war on terror. And for them, it played out in everything from an overall shortage of properly armored vehicles to their coming home to a Veterans Administration that was both ill-funded and ill-equipped to handle this new wave of war veterans.
I see, okay.
Yeah, so their soldiers, or these soldiers, like many who follow them, were providing support services in a war with no clear lines between the combat battle zones and the rear safeguard havens. And in the 2 years the 893rd was deployed, its members saw a dramatic shift in the public support from flag-waving patriots to true war skeptics. The release of the photos from Abu Ghraib raised questions about reserve units like the 893rd, whose assignments closely paralleled the assignment of the reservists who worked at Abu Ghraib and gave the entire reserve system essentially a black eye.
So did you hear about the reservists being told to stop talking about the subject, or were the authors told directly by U.S. officials? And what do you think of that response, and what kind of reactions are they getting or hearing about reservists being told to be quiet, if any, since it's so crucial that these Americans have a voice?
Well, we did hear from colleagues at conferences in larger research institutions that they were having a more difficult time gaining access to soldiers. But we ourselves didn't experience any of the difficulties in working with the 893rd, and the ability to give voice to the reservists was central, as Michael said, to our motivation. And while many people had warned us going into the field that soldiers would likely not open up to outsiders such as us, we actually had a difficult time keeping our one-on-one conversations with them to under an hour and a half or 2 hours worth of time.
Yeah,
they were long interviews, and they wanted to be able to tell their stories and had hoped that in doing so, they might make a more positive difference in the lives of other reservists. And then after finishing the book, we spoke with several former members of the company, and they're quite pleased to know that their experiences may help inform future military policy.
Okay. So when you were gathering the interviews that you conducted, what sorts of patterns or parallels did you find among the reservists, if any?
Well, I can pick up on that. When we listened to the voices of the 46 members of the 893rd for whom we conducted interviews, we didn't really find a potpourri of individual stories of completely distinct experiences, nor did we find a kind of single overarching story of what might be portrayed in a movie as, you know, the citizen soldier experience.
Mm-hmm,
yes. Instead, we came to realize that there were three clusters of stories of citizen soldiering after 9/11, at least that's how we interpreted it. One of the clusters of citizen soldiers that we call adaptive reservists adjust quickly. They move kind of lockstep with the changing institutional expectations that are placed upon them, and they do this because they have a really dynamic sense of their identity, and they have these relational networks that run really deep at home and in their communities and even within the military. These reservists cut across gender groups to include men, particularly those who've had past experience in international deployments, as well as all the female reservists who had been essentially raised in military families.
Okay.
Other citizen soldiers that we came to call struggling reservists juggle the many homegrown stresses of what really are pretty shaky civilian lives that they leave behind as they take on very demanding military duties. These men, and all of them but one really are men, express some combination of discontent, disappointment, disillusionment, disapproval from those who surround them in their civilian lives, And they, oddly, came to see their deployments as comforting, even if they were experiencing war-grown troubles, because their homegrown troubles were so substantial in the sense they could escape them by being deployed. And then there was really a third cluster of voices. These we call resistant reservists, and they're really dismissive of military life while they live it, and they're against the war even as they fight it. These citizen soldiers get out of the military as soon as possible, and yet they have many attributes that are most valuable to today's military. They're ambitious. They're analytical. They're more educated than many of their peers, and they are truly patriotic.
Okay. Were there surprises along the way, or any things that you found that were unexpected?
Well, Joe, the short answer to that is yes.
Right.
There were certainly some surprises. It really started from the very first soldier that we had conversation with, who was just desperately eager to have his voice heard. And so, like I mentioned earlier, we had gone into the field having been warned, particularly by military veterans, that military personnel would be really reluctant to talk to civilian researchers about their experiences. But there really was this genuine eagerness among many of the citizen soldiers to have someone somewhere take an interest in learning of the sacrifices that they had made.
Yes.
For what was becoming what they saw as becoming an increasingly ungrateful nation. So they were, and they were often dismayed by the short-lived civilian concern for their experiences and the sacrifices that they'd made. And this was despite the fact that leaving Iraq, when they were in Kuwait and going through debriefing sessions, they had heard from the debriefing sessions that, you know, people really don't care where you've been or what you've done. And so then, in talking with us, I think they really wanted military planners and military families to learn from their particular experiences. But I think, Michael, do you want to handle, or do you want to talk a little bit about then kind of some of the surprises within the stories themselves?
Yeah, I think there are really two things that were probably the most surprising and run quite counter to the popular renditions of soldiering. First, we really did not expect to find a large cluster of adaptive reservists. The heavy emphasis in the literature on war-induced trauma did not prepare us for hearing stories of reservists pleased to have had their years of training put to a test and still living in happily intact families, in the words of one soldier's, families who made, you know, lemonade out of lemons. Many of these citizen soldiers we spoke with were seriously contemplating transferring to the full-time active duty component of the Army after their deployments, but were essentially held back because of their responsibilities, obligations, and sense of really duty to their families and their communities. So this group of adaptive reservists just doesn't show up even in the popular media, and it doesn't show up in the academic literature, but clearly we found them and we heard their voices. Second, we didn't expect to find that so many of the soldiers who were clearly struggling in their personal lives were struggling long before they were deployed. While the deployment certainly exacerbated their personal struggles, they were most often not the cause of the reservist struggles. These were individuals whose lives were highly troubled and stressed and strained well before they were deployed to Iraq.
Okay, which sort of leads to my next question about you write that some soldiers' troubles are as much homegrown as they are war-grown. Can you explain that?
Well, the men and women of the 893rd were living their lives on September 10th, 2001, you know, without the anticipation that in the coming weeks their lives would become dominated by the U.S. Army. While serving in the reserves required, well, weekend and summer training, all of the reservists we came to know were more actively engaged in their civilian lives than certainly their military lives up until and including September 10th. For those we call struggling reservists, though, their lives were already out of control well before 9/11, unfortunately. For a young man dealing with an unwanted pregnancy, as an example, an unanticipated and extended military service only exacerbates that problem.
Okay.
If a family with significant emotional or financial troubles depended on a female reservist to keep that family afloat, her deployment, you know, stressed out the family members back home, and they lashed out at her. They would lash out at a female reservist like I've just described, even while she had her hands full dealing with unruly prisoners of war as a team that was running a makeshift prison near Baghdad. So these are the types of problems that the reservists dealt with that we dub homegrown struggles, whereas war-grown struggles are those the more typically thought of as negatively impacting soldiers' lives due to the traumas of being in a war zone.
Okay, so you say that some of the soldiers oppose the war even as they take pride in fighting it. What do you mean by that, and what do their fellow soldiers think of that stance? Susan?
Well, Joe, you know, although individuals volunteer for military service, you know, no soldier gets to select the war or pick the war in which he or she is going to be called to duty. And the resistant reservists joined the military because of this great pride they felt in being an American, and they had a desire to give something back in return. So they're ideologically driven, and they take pride in having established themselves as sort of men among men, and also in having made these tremendous sacrifices to the country. But at the same time that they're proud of their sacrifices, no amount of rationalization will convince them that they've somehow participated in a justified war in Iraq.
Why do you call reservists the new conscripts of the 21st century U.S. Army?
Yeah, that's definitely a good question. We call them that really to awaken the public to the extreme sacrifices this small number of our citizens are making, while most of us have really been allowed to avoid any sacrifices in one of the longest wars in American history. There really is no precedent in our history that we've been able to find or are aware of for calling on so few of our citizens to multiple wartime deployments while calling upon so little of the rest of us.
Right.
Many of the reservists we came to know willingly left their civilian jobs and families twice, including their serving nearly a year in Iraq, but they've really grown distrustful of the military and uncertain about their futures, not knowing whether there is any end to their so-called volunteering to serve the country.
Okay.
They feel entrapped by an army that demands so much of them and that they think returns much less than they feel they deserve.
Okay.
Susan might be able to, I don't know, what about the voice of a soldier who reveals this perspective?
Well, I think the response response to this inequity of service was felt fully in the comments of an enlisted reservist that we call Troy Bixler, who's a young college student and the son of a former military man. And although he eagerly anticipated military service, in hindsight, he puts it this way, and I quote him, I actually got to the point where I felt like the Army was going to use me until I died, as in died while I was doing my job. Because after being deployed once and being deployed again, I was like, well, so obviously I can't be deployed again because I'm dead.
Wow.
Yeah. There's some powerful voices in there.
Yeah. Do you think there are parallels to or differences from Vietnam in the way reservists are used today?
I think there are really some significant parallels, and I think it's worth going back to the very early days of the Vietnam War. In the early months of 1965, U.S. executive and military leaders agreed that the Vietnam War was going badly, even though this is not something we and those who were alive at this time in the public really were told much about. This was a time really when elite units of the South Vietnamese Army were already being defeated by the Viet Cong in major battles, and North Vietnamese Army units were beginning to move into South Korea, South Vietnam, and there was really deep concern in the hierarchy of the military leadership and political leadership that the North was preparing for an all-out offensive on Saigon, now Ho Chi Minh City. it was a time in which, a really critical time, in which President Lyndon Johnson made the decision to escalate the war over an alternative that was posed to him by some of his advisors to negotiate as favorable withdrawal as possible and for the U.S. to simply pull back from Vietnam in 1965. But once Johnson took the decision to escalate, the debate, a debate that really has not been told much in the public domain, the debate quickly shifted to how such a force would be put together and deployed if indeed escalation was the decision. And the military leadership clearly wanted the president to declare an emergency and call up the reserve. They reasoned that deployment of reserve forces would put the public on notice that America was at war and really provide the Army with experienced junior officers in the field. President Johnson and leadership in the U.S. Congress realized that a call-up of the reserve would put the war front and center in American politics, and that would get in the way of the president's really ambitious domestic policy agenda. He was very active on the domestic side, and he didn't want to divert from that in 1965. Mm-hmm. So the president decided to rely on expanding the draft over mobilizing reserve forces, and as a consequence, the reserve as an institution was literally ripped apart. I must tell you, he did this over strong objections from the leadership of the military, but of course they had to bow their will to his civilian leadership of the military, and even though they contemplated a mass resignation, they conformed. The established members of the reserve, particularly its sergeants and officers, you have to remember at that time were veterans of the active military, and they were veterans of previous military campaigns going all the way back to the Korean War. While these reservists were not anxious to go to war, they had strong ties to the military, and they really had a substantial experience to draw upon were they to be deployed to war zones. With the president's decision to withhold these forces, the reserve really also became a refuge for the disaffected and really a haven for those whose connections allowed them to avoid the draft, and that's what led to really the reserve being torn apart during the Vietnam War.
Okay. Well, why do we rely so heavily on citizen soldiers and the reserve and National Guard for fighting the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan?
Well, one of the casualties of the Vietnam War was the end of the draft in July of 1973. Even though the question of how to raise armies has really been a controversy within the United States since the nation's founding. Throughout most of its history, though, the United States has relied on a draft to conduct these protracted ground wars, including World War II. But with the end of the draft in 73, the task to put together an army was left to General Creighton Abrams, who you might recall is a legendary combat commander in World War II, and for whom the Abrams tank has been named after, and a high-ranking officer during the Vietnam War. So following the war as the Army's chief of staff, Abrams put into motion a policy which he called the Total Force Doctrine that would eventually come to restore the reputation of the reserves and determine the fate of the reserves as a force deployed en masse in Afghanistan and in Iraq after 9/11. So I don't know, Michael, if you want to pick up a little more on that.
Well, yeah, I think... Again, going back to this legendary soldier who, you know, was credited with breaking through the German offensive in the Ardennes during World War II, he, like many of his contemporaries, was deeply disturbed by President Johnson's decision to what they called tiptoe into Vietnam without the public's full awareness and commitment. He saw soldiers perform bravely and consistently under battlefield conditions because he was on the ground in Vietnam, but he also witnessed growing difficulties that he attributed to the reliance on conscription without public backing. So Abrams and his colleagues regarded the mobilization of reserve forces as a crucial decision that must be taken any time America was contemplating engagement of its forces in a sustained combat operation. The reserve provides the Army with experienced officers and And it also heightens public awareness about war because it draws upon citizens from across rural areas, towns, and of course cities of America.
Okay.
The Army put together after Vietnam, after the draft was ended, involved really three separate components. And it, of course, the component we know most about in the public domain is the professional active duty soldiers who form most of the combat forces of our Army. But also the active duty component of these professional soldiers is augmented by what Abrams called round-out combat forces that are made up of elements of the National Guard. So there are combat citizen soldiers. Most of them come from the National Guard.
Okay.
And so the third kind of component of this strategy that Abrams developed after Vietnam was that the responsibility of the reserve was going to largely be to provide the support needed to maintain an army in the field for sustained combat. Everything from medics to cargo handlers, maintenance and transportation personnel, and of course, for military police like the 893rd. So as the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan became protracted wars rather than a quick war like the first Gulf War, the Army really put this total force doctrine that Abrams constructed after the defeat in Vietnam into practice. And that resulted in this extremely heavy reliance on particular reserve forces in a war where the lines between combat and military support are blurred and danger is ever present. Typically, today, as we really talk, and for years now, a third of the forces serving in the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq have been, and of course remain to be, reserve forces.
Okay, so who are these citizen soldiers and where did they come from?
Well, Joe, there's a couple of ways that we could describe them, but in terms of geography, the reservists of the 893rd, like those from units around the country, are representative of the American public to some extent. They come from big cities, from suburbs, small towns, rural areas. So I talked to, in when we talked to them, we talked to people who were really geographically quite diverse. But their social characteristics, though, are more particular to the civilian workforce that's blue-collar rather than white-collar. And although they hold a range of jobs, they're heavily represented within the 893rd in the civilian sector in the service economy and among the frontline civilian servants, civilian servants such as police and corrections officers.
Okay.
A substantial number of them are ambitious first or second generation college students who are going to a variety of colleges and universities, and before their deployments were at a variety of stages there, whether they were first semester students or fourth year, you know, getting ready to graduate, and most of them were paying for their education in large part through their service to the reserve. But then the Army Reserve, more generally, has its highest percentage of female and minority soldiers of any of the three components of the military that Michael just described, with about one third of the membership being African American or Hispanic, and about 14% are female. And then, you know, I think we know that the overrepresentation of minorities in the military is an often-cited rationale for reinstating the draft. And with the advent of the all-volunteer military, there's been a marked transformation in the composition of the military personnel, particularly in terms of their marital status. A growing number of the soldiers are married, and approximately 40% of all reservists have children. Many of the non-commissioned and commissioned officers were professional soldiers before they transferred into the reserves or had rejoined the military through the reserves. So most of the citizen soldiers that we came to know were motivated to join the reserve to better themselves economically or to enhance their sense of themselves. They take pride in having a part of their personal identity closely associated with the military.
I've heard some people say that the reservists and members of the Guard should be making the sacrifices after 9/11 because they joined voluntarily and have been getting benefits from the government for years that the rest of us don't have. What's your response to that?
Well, like us, many of our friends and acquaintances have had to make few, if any, sacrifices since 9/11. And when we started talking about our view that citizen soldiers are the new conscripts of today's United States Army, we too kept hearing that same refrain. But these guys volunteered for the military service. They received the benefits, including money for college, and that all goes with signing up. And so now they should be expected to fulfill their duties.
Yeah, we thought a lot about these comments, and in our view, the fact that the reservists are volunteered to become reservists, get paid, and have some benefits, does not solve the inequity problem that a very small number of our citizens are carrying the full weight of a war on their soldiers. Our designation, I think, of them as conscripts is intended to awaken the public to the sacrifices they've made and really draw attention of decision makers to halt what we really see as the abuse of reservists to sustain a protracted war in Iraq that, in our view, is neither just nor in any way in the interests of the United States.
How have the Iraq and Afghanistan wars changed, if they have changed, the way we maintain forces such as the reservists, the National Guard, or Army volunteers? Do you think that the way we maintain forces will undergo a transformation in the future as a result of what's happened in the Iraq and Afghanistan wars?
Well, it's certainly our hope. But we're not naive. I guess the best way to sort of frame that is to, if you go back in our history, even beginning with founding President George Washington, many leaders in the U.S. have called for universal national service of the American public as part of our duties, really, as citizens.
Mm-hmm.
And this, of course, is a duty of citizenship in other countries around the world. But
right.
But when push comes to shove, the raising of an army to fight a ground war has always fallen, and just always fallen disproportionately on the less privileged of American citizens. We don't see this changing, particularly when patriotic fervor wanes and a war becomes prolonged and less popular. American military leaders reasoned after the Vietnam War that making the reserve integral to the ground war would sober the political leadership of this country in taking the decision to go to war and make it a difficult decision. But having sort of done that and developed this total force strategy, it really didn't stop the most recent march to war by our political leadership. And so we're back to a point where, you know, here we go again. The public is skeptical of our political leadership, distrustful of the media's accounting of what led up to the war, and more aware of the cost of a protracted war. That probably, I mean, it probably will put a brake on going into another war in the near term, but it leaves our nation quite vulnerable to political and media propaganda when our firsthand memories fade and still without a solution to our longstanding struggle over how to raise an army that can fight successfully when necessary and serve at the same time as a brake on political leadership when it's not necessary.
Yes.
We agree with those, I think, you know, that we agree with those who advocate for a program of national service that provides citizens with options, including becoming reservists. But we're not, again, I think we're just not so naive to think about that the story we tell about the sacrifices of the 893rd and this company of reservists will turn the tide. But it may fall upon the ears of future leaders who will hopefully require more sacrifices of the many and make clear the boundaries of sacrifices that are required of the few.
Okay. Well, Michael Mushnow and Susan Ross, thank you so much for talking to us about this incredible book that you've written. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Joe. Appreciate your time with us.
Deployed dramatizes the soldiers' situations by quoting many of the reservists directly. The following are excerpts of the reservists' own words taken from Deployed. The passages quote Troy Bixler and Michelle Colton. The names have been changed to protect the identity of the soldiers. One of the reservists, Troy Bixler, tries to argue that the company's mission in Iraq was worth his personal sacrifices, but in doing so, he ends up making a relatively angry point that the demands placed on reservists are at odds with the domestic culture engaged in conspicuous consumption and an increasing separation from the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Here, Troy speaks. I'd have to say that a citizen soldier, one word to sum it all up, is sacrifice. As a soldier, when you go overseas, or anywhere for that matter, deployed, even homeland, you're not there for you. Holy smokes, I mean, I wasn't even there for me. I was there for the 300 million American citizens that are sitting in the country sucking on their chocolate milk at night and watching the Flintstones on the television. Later, Troy does little to hide his disgust with the changes in military policy and the heavy-priced reservists are paying. It makes me so angry to think that the Army feels that it has the right to extend people's contracts and hold them past their original orders. Who do they think they are? And there's nothing you can do about it, you know. And then that's what happens, is if you talk to people higher up in the chain, you'll get this brainwashed rhetoric that they just spew endlessly, and it's almost like they try to put aside the fact that people are flesh and blood and have heart and soul, you know. And, oh, it's your duty and mine. I have already had people, you know, asking me from inside the Army, why aren't you going to re-enlist? Oh, blah, 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 you know, trying to make you feel bad, like you haven't done enough for your country. Yet the Army's only 1.2 million people. There are 300 million people in America. Look at the percentage of people in the service right now, and yet even in the Army, they try to make you feel like you haven't done enough if you tell them you're not going to re-enlist. I'm just like, that's so wrong. They can break their own laws, their own regs. They do it all the time. Contracts, they break them all the time. Hold people in. So, I know they can. And it's unfortunate because you have to hold up your end of the bargain, but they don't have to hold up theirs.
While the majority of the struggling soldiers are men who express their views about war and relationships in masculine terms, Michelle Colton's experiences also illustrate the difficulties struggling soldiers face. Michelle comes across as a bit of a tomboy, and with her short bobbed hairstyle within military regulations, it is easy to mistake her for someone still in her mid-teens rather than a young woman of 22. However, engaging Michelle in conversation reveals someone with experiences and responsibilities of a mature woman well beyond her age. Prior to 9/11, Michelle was already struggling to make her way in the world, and the deployments ironically provided her temporary relief from incredible household responsibilities. Here, Michelle Colton speaks. In my household, it's only me, my mom, and my grandmother, and I basically have all the responsibility for them. Me and my mom share the responsibility of taking care of my grandmother, but I feel that I'm the mom sometimes, so that when I left, my mom actually had to take responsibility. She used to go just to work, come home, go to sleep, wake up, go to work. It was easy for her, and I was trying to go to school at one point and full-time job, come home, do all that, and she never had to worry about it. But as soon as I was deployed for the first time, it was a big shock to her, and the first deployment was pretty rough. She didn't take that first deployment well at all. The responsibility she took on, she started getting angry because she was like, I don't want to do this, or she was getting frustrated with my grandmother. My grandmother didn't show her appreciation, and I was like, now you see what I went through while I was there. She couldn't handle it. She wasn't used to me not being around, and I had to get home on an emergency leave because she let the stress get to her too much, and she tried to do something crazy. So I had to go back there and smooth everything out again. And I remember I wasn't going to come back from Fort McHenry. I was going to transfer and stay at Fort McHenry because I loved it there so much. And it was I just didn't want to come back to that either.
We've been talking to Michael Mushnow and Susan M. Ross, authors of Deployed, How Reservists Bear the Burden of Iraq, published by the University of Michigan Press. If you'd like to learn more about our other books, please visit us on the web at press.umich.edu. This podcast has been brought to you by the University of Michigan Press, copyright 2008, all rights reserved.